Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. Now, if you're a regular listener to this programme, you'll be well aware that UBS is interested in addressing the big questions that shape our world. To help best answer them, they've sought out a number of Nobel laureates in the economic sciences to ask them to share insights, discuss their research and open their ever-inquiring minds. This week, we're hearing from one such, Michael Spence, winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, winning that centenary edition for his work on the dynamics of information flow and market development. Spence is the former dean of the Stanford Graduate School of Business, a professor at NYU Stern, and chairman of the Independent Commission on Growth and Development. As a Canadian-born American citizen who's lived in the US, in Europe, and spent much time in Asia, he has a global perspective like few others. And that's the theme that I started with when I sat down with Michael in London a little earlier. I put it to Michael that his international worldview has undoubtedly served his work, his life, well. It's fired his curiosity and his quest for innovation. Could it be then that such a mindset would better serve everyone, especially in a time when so much of the discourse is dominated by discussion about fear of the other? Could we all be a little more global in our thinking, whether you're an economist or whatever you're doing?
I actually do think it's important. You know, if you go back in time, so everybody's personal journey is kind of idiosyncratic. In my own case, I grew up in Canada, ended up working in the United States, studied at Oxford, had a career that was research and teaching, and then academic administration for 15 years, and then more engaged with developing countries and growth issues around the world. And a lot of travel associated with that. But I go back, you know, when the United States and China were trying to normalize their relationships, and one of the things that tends to be forgotten is part of that program was bringing people from both sides back and forth to get to know each other. And while I don't think that necessarily solves the problem of tamping down tensions that are naturally there, it certainly helps if you have people that you know. I think actually friends is kind of the really crucial thing. So, you know, because it gives a human face, right? Them isn't just a bunch of kind of people who, none of whom I know. And I think that does change people's attitudes. And it's a very difficult thing to achieve, obviously, because, you know, having everybody have friends in, you know, several other countries is not an easy thing to achieve. But I think it's, and visiting doesn't quite do it. Right? I mean, it's more, slightly more engagement than that. But I do think that's important. And without it, you have this tendency of, as you put it, you know, fear, disrespect, or just not caring. So I think one of the miraculous things that's happened in the post-war period is that literally hundreds of millions of people are living better than they, maybe not the way we live, but much better than, you know, when developing countries first started to grow. I mean, these are countries that had per capita incomes of, you know, under $500, certainly under $1,000 per year. And a lot of them now are middle-class families, you know, two and a half, three generations later. So I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, there are people who think, well, if it happened in China or India, it doesn't matter. So there is this, we're all in it together, meaning all the humans on the globe, isn't really an accurate description of how we feel intuitively.
You already talked about the sort of thawing of relations historically between China and the US. If we look at Sino-US relations now, mm-hmm. particularly in sort of trade capacity, obviously we know what the headlines are. It's sort of disappointing, it's a worry. I don't want to ask you an impossible question, but what do you think is behind that stoking of tensions? Is it just about particular political characters and what's expedient for them day to day? Because it seems to sort of be out of step with progress and a progressive worldview about diplomacy, trade, global economics, the raising of more people out of poverty into becoming a middle class and so on. It seems out of step, but is there something more deep-rooted, or can we attribute that to individuals, to the tenor of politics these days?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer precisely. So, you know, in that context, I usually listen to opinions that I respect. I think it's deeper than just individual personalities. I mean, when I wrote the book, The Next Convergence, it was about 10 years ago, you could see this coming. So China then was a rapidly growing economy that was still relatively small. But if you go back 15 years, it was smaller than Germany. then it passed Germany, and then more recently it passed Japan. And so the only two economies that are bigger are the U.S. economy and the European economy, depending on how whether you think Europe is a unit or a bunch of separate entities. But at those growth rates, and it looked like it was sustainable to me, China was going to be a major player. And there was likely to come a time in which their economic size and impact on the rest of the world would be reflected in the way they interacted with everybody else. So sphere of influence in Asia, much larger say in how the world gets organized, the global economy, and so on. And now I think, you know, to skip ahead, we've gotten to the point where with Europe a little bit, for understandable reasons, sort of in introspective mode, trying to deal with problems in the internal structure and so on, you basically have a completely new regime. And the new regime is economic, strategic, technological competition between the United States and China. And it's not maybe the only organizing principle, but, you know, if you ignore that that's one of the main things going on in the global economy, it'll be pretty hard to understand anything else that's going on. So I think that, and that's not going to go away. Mm-hmm. Now, what's uncertain is what combination of cooperation and competition, you know, will emerge from this rivalry between these major powers, one established, one rising. That's just a completely different world than the world in which the developed economies basically set up a bunch of constructed rules that created the global economy, and everybody else did their best within that context. And it worked pretty well. I mean, even for the developing countries, that was a great system. And when people say, I want to preserve multilateralism, there's a good reason for that. The problem is the word preserve. Keep some version of multilateralism is really important for a lot of people and countries, especially early stage developing countries, because they need access to the global economy. And there's a risk they'll be sideswiped in this, you know, new regime. But the notion that, we, you know, the trade war will die down and then we'll go back to some version of what we had before with maybe slightly altered rules, I think is highly unlikely. In addition to all of those things, and then I'll stop, is there's a clear rising pattern of nationalism virtually everywhere, at least in the developed world. And that's not going to go away, you know, easily. So there's a kind of imperfectly understood, in terms of cause, retreat from, you know, the march toward increasing integration, which is what globalization is really all about. You can see it happening in Europe. You can see it happening in America. It's everywhere.
To that point, I just wonder about this broader sort of openness to the global economy. And I wonder whether if we look to China, for example, there is, if you think of this driver to extraordinary sustained period of growth over, what, a quarter of a century or so?
40 years.
I mean, it seems very hard to kind of comprehend that in some respects. Do you need to, I don't know, future-proof that to sustain that kind of growth? Is there an implicit requirement to be investing in technologies, sort of looking to the future? Is that part of what drives the growth? We'll maybe talk a bit more about sort of growth frameworks. So I know something you've done lots of work on before.
Yeah.
But do you need to be future-proofing to sustain that kind of growth in the world today, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you take the world right after World War II, 15% of the people lived in what was then thought of as developed economies with relatively high incomes, not high by today's standards. So those economies have grown, and war recovery occurred, and lots of good things happened. And then the developing countries, where 85% of the world's population lives, or more, depending on which demographics you're looking at, joined the party, right? So if you conduct the thought experiment of moving them into, this is a century-long process, moving them into advanced country status with those incomes, those consumption levels, those energy usage levels, and so on, you're basically increased the global economy by inclusion by, I don't know, pick a number, 6 times. And that's where the sustainability issues come in. Everything, you know, water, agriculture, soil, climate, oceans, you name it. It's just the reason we belatedly have discovered that, you know, sustainability in multiple dimensions is really crucial, because we're trying to accomplish an exercise in inclusion, you know, on a scale that's never been seen before.
Well, Mike, I wonder then if we talk in more broad terms about sustainability and sustaining growth, given those challenges, do we need to some degree to accept levels of inequality, exclusion, as you just said? And are they split between the developing world and the developed world, or do we also see them even within developed markets? Is it inevitable that to develop those kinds of growth frameworks, you have that multi-track approach? Presumably yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, at some level, the answer is yes. You don't have to accept, you know, very high levels of inequality anywhere. And the global pattern is declining inequality, basically because the poor people are getting, you know, richer and higher income. But that's counterbalanced by rising inequality within economies. Some of that is normal in a developing economy when they start growing. Never mind how that happens. But so they're in this no-growth equilibrium and everybody's poor. And there isn't a lot of inequality, or frequently there isn't, because, you know, everybody's poor. So how much inequality can have if everybody's per capita income is $500? And then the growth process generates some degree of increasing inequality, inevitably. I mean, for reasons that are understood. So that growth process basically moves people from traditional sectors where there's surplus labor into the modern economy, but it doesn't happen overnight. So the ones who move first have their incomes go up first. And so then it can get worse. I mean, after that, then, you know, presumably inequality should come down, and frequently it doesn't. So it's high in China, for example. It's part of their challenge, is to tamp down the sort of rising, you know, the Gini coefficient in China is over 0.45. America's between 0.4 and 0.45. Europe is all in the 30s or even the 20s. So Latin America would be in the 60s, coming down into the 50s, and some of Africa, where we can measure it, would be similar. And that's a particular kind of colonial history that produces those outcomes, probably mainly places where there wasn't a major asset redistribution, including land. The last part of the answer to your question is when climate change sort of finally became something that wasn't just the property of scientists, sort of trying to convince people that there was actually a problem, and people started to talk about doing something about it. The first step, we decided it was a global problem, so everybody got involved. And then the people who are framing this issue went to the developing countries and said, you got to participate in this. And they said, well, actually, we don't want to. You cause the problem, you fix it. And the answer to that was, we can't fix it by ourselves because you're the ones who are growing. And so that seems to have gotten accepted. But the initial outings were, I mean, I think the instinct was, the only way to solve this problem is not to have that growth. And since most of that growth, you know, was going to be in the developing countries, that's a non-starter from the word go. You can't go tell people that, I mean, implementing that solution would produce a permanent divide of the type that we had coming into, you know, the pre-war period. It was 200 years of 15% growing and the others staying where they were in colonial structures of a variety of kinds. The rest of the answer, I think we've gotten there now, is you can't tell people this growth is unacceptable. So you have to solve the problem with a combination of regulation, technology, and commitment. And that's the process we're in.
Given the pace of change and given an understandable, I guess, Mike, short-termism in the political classes, I just wonder, are you reassured that the critical governance post, whether that's central banks, or certainly if we look at governments of nation states, can they keep pace to these sorts of developments? Can they factor it into their thinking? Is there a willingness from them? I mean, you presumably speak to people who ask your views on these things. Because, you know, if you're only worried about what happens at the ballot box, or if you're the current incumbent in the White House, you're just worried about sort of winning today in PR terms, mm-hmm. You're not interested in 1 year's hence, let alone 10 down the line. Should we worry at the short-termism given this pace of change in the rest of the economy and the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should, and lots of people do. I mean, in various forms. So there's an influential group of people who are trying to get financial markets and corporate governance structures to stop being short-term oriented. That's not the political system. And people definitely worry about whether or not we have the bandwidth in the political system to do long-term things. You know, I'm a little less... I mean, the proposition that if you have to get elected every 2 years or four or whatever it is, you know, that automatically shortens your horizon is in some sense intuitively plausible and correct. But there are democracies that have done pretty well in terms of long-term growth and the investments that are required to support it. They're not perfect. They get lost along the way. They have, you know, ups and downs. And my favorite example is India. You know, when people say, well, the rather more centralized power in many of the Asian economies, where China's the typical example now, but the earlier cases of rapid growth in Asia also had dominant single-party structures for a while. Most of them have morphed into real multi-party things, I think because middle-class people want to have a real multi-party system for its own sake, not for economic development, but for its own sake. They want to have a voice. But then there's India, you know, which is humming along at 7.5%, and they got going a little more slowly, and they had a bad lull in the second Congress, you know, term before the BJP took over. But they're basically getting the job done. So I think there's reason to be skeptical of the simple proposition that democracies can't have long-term goals. And I think what people now think about, and it's worth thinking about, is whether you need to try to create structures within, you know, democratic governance, overall architectures that are insulated enough to maintain a long-term. So do you want to have a public investment thing that's somewhat insulated from political pressure in the way that central banks are, for example? People are toying with these ideas. We have central banks, for sure, with some degree of independence, and there's fairly widespread agreement that that's a good thing, in part because we just went through an episode that if they had been crippled too, we'd be dead. I mean, economically dead. So, but that's kind of, you know, in process, so to speak. So nobody knows the answer. But I mean, so these pressures exist, but they're not so powerful that you can't get the job done eventually. Periods of rapid change are very difficult because it's just hard to keep up. It's hard for everybody to keep up. I mean, I think one of the things that artificial intelligence will do when they become everybody's sidekick is allow you to keep up. You know, so if you're a doctor and there's this ballooning batch of, you know, really important literature and biomedical science, some of which you really ought to read and you can't, you know, I suspect that artificial intelligence systems are going to kind of help you get that job done, not replace you, you know, just be your really smart assistant. One aspect of digital technology, so most of the discussion is about privacy, security, and job loss through automation. Then there's a bunch of other stuff that isn't well understood, which is there's a whole bunch of potential to create new business models, jobs, and innovation. You can see it in and around the Chinese mega platforms, partly because they're asset light, so they have to be open. And this the former head of strategy at Alibaba, Ming Zhang, has written a really interesting book you might want to look at. It describes this, these ecosystems that are digitally enabled and architected by the platform, but pretty open. And then there's the early stage developing countries. So one of the things that makes it hard to talk about the digital technologies is there's so many different directions that there's impacts. But there's pretty good evidence now that that automation in manufacturing is sufficiently far along that it's within shooting distance of exceeding, in terms of cost and quality, the labor-intensive, process-oriented manufacturing and assembly. And you might say, well, that's interesting, but who cares? Well, that turns out is the entry point for non-resource-rich countries in the development process. It's the entry point in the global economy. It's the way they get. These are powerful growth engines. You can't really grow an economy that's poor on its own domestic demand, right? Because, I mean, what's domestic demand, right? It doesn't matter, pick anything. Well, first of all, it's housing, food, and a few other things, and that's it. The second thing is, even if there's other things, they're small, right? So you get good at doing something and you hit the boundary of the market immediately. In the global economy, there is no boundary for practical purposes, you know, to the market. I mean, because, well, there is a boundary, but it's so far away. If you're 1 or 2%, you know, I tell the students in the class, I said, so suppose you have 2% of the market and you're just getting started and you grow at 50% in 1 year, which never happens. Then, and the market doesn't grow, you're 3%. Big deal. Not going to affect the prices, not going to do anything. So that's the growth engine, right? It's the technology coming in, and then you sell to this nearly infinite market. And that's how early stage developing countries grow, except you have to sell something. And the entry point has almost always been textiles, apparel, and stuff like that, sewing trades. And the reason was because they required humans, and they required a lot of humans, and they weren't automatable till now. Now you can do electronics assembly with robots, and you can't make a shirt yet that's high quality. You can make a shirt, but my friends who are entrepreneurs in Hong Kong who are trying to do this in China, but you can't get the stitching straight enough to make one for Hugo Boss or something like that. But that won't be true forever. So then the question for those of us who care about these early stage developing countries, the ones who got started late and aren't really in the party yet, the question is, what's the growth model?
The brilliant insights of Michael Spence, Nobel laureate, providing another set of Nobel perspectives here on the Bulletin with UBS. To read more from and about Michael Spence and his work, and to discover how Nobel perspectives shape the UBS worldview, head to ubs.com and search Nobel Perspectives. You can listen again to this programme or find out more at monocle.com or catch up via your preferred podcast platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.